And so the Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
All right, good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is July 15, 2020. This panel of the court today has three cases set for oral argument, each of them by WebEx video software. We are now prepared to hear the second case on today's calendar. Case number A20-122, State versus Anthony James Harrell. As counsel know, you each have 15 minutes for your initial arguments. You should be able to see the time clock at all times, given the number of people we have online. If at any time you don't see it, feel free to stop and ask me, and we can make sure that you can see your time available. Mr. Schmidt, counsel for respondent, I just want to make sure that you can see and hear me and that we can see and hear you. Could you affirm that for me, please?
Yes, sir. I can see you, Judge.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Young, assuming that you are also fully connected, you may begin your argument on behalf of appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. On March 8, 2018, a fully armed Minneapolis SWAT team broke into a North Minneapolis home based on allegations of marijuana sales. This appeal is about whether that forced, unannounced entry by the Minneapolis SWAT team was justified and constitutional. The request for an unannounced entry in this case was supported by what boils down to a single allegation contained in just two sentences of the warrant application. That allegation was that the resident possessed a firearm. In Minnesota, forced entries by fully armed SWAT teams are not taken lightly, and for good reason. They present a serious risk to public safety and represent an extreme intrusion upon individual liberties and privacy interests. For that reason, in this state, officers must make a strong showing of sufficiently particularized circumstances that justify an unannounced entry. The state must show a significant danger to officer safety or a significant likelihood of destruction of evidence.
Counsel,
none of those
counsel,
were present.
On page 5 of the application, at the very conclusion of the application, there is a line that does say that the cooperator indicated that the suspect utilizes the firearm as a means of protection for his controlled substance sales. Why is that not a sufficiently particular allegation to justify a no-knock warrant to ensure officer safety?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. That's what I wanted to get to. Let's jump right into the language of the warrant application. So the language you're referencing, and you know, this is a 5-page warrant application, and this is just the single paragraph that really supports what the officer is saying, meets the state's burden for an unannounced entry in this case. There's one paragraph at the top of page 5. This is actually page 5 to appellant's addendum as well. And it begins, an unannounced entry is necessary. And those two sentences state, the cooperating defendant in this case indicated that the target of this investigation, Barth, that was a mistaken individual, we're actually referring to the resident of the home, is in possession of a firearm. The cooperator further went on to indicate that Barth utilizes this firearm as a means of protection for his controlled substance sales. Now that's it. That's the only allegations contained in this 5-page warrant application that the state says meets its strong showing of sufficiently particularized circumstances justifying a no knock. So let's break that down. You know, the first sentence you have, it's just alleging possession of a firearm, nothing more. It's saying this resident is a gun owner. That's not a sufficiently particularized circumstance. The state's not taking the position in this case that you being a gun owner allows officers to conduct an unannounced entry. That's not enough. So the state's relying completely on this single sentence saying utilizes this firearm as a means of protection for his controlled substance sales. The reason that doesn't meet the burden is it's incredibly vague. There is absolutely no specificity in that allegation. We're looking at what is the reliability here in what the cooperating defendant purportedly said. And
what the legal standard for specificity is. I mean, if you're saying that that's not a sufficiently specific statement within the warrant, what's the standard there to determine what would be a sufficiently specific statement?
Well, yeah, so the standard is, you know, a strong showing of sufficiently particularized circumstances of what we're looking at here is not destruction of evidence, but, you know, dangerousness to officer safety or a threat to officer safety. And there are specific factors that the court looks at. It's set forth in Botello. And one of them is, you know, the specificity of the facts alleged, the reliability of the source of those allegations, the recentness of the facts suggesting dangerousness, and then, you know, any other factors. And why I'd say this is not specific enough is you have a single sentence with a vague allegation, but where are the details of why the cooperating defendant knows this? I mean, if the cooperating defendant is alleging that this individual has used guns in connection with drug sales, how does the cooperating defendant know this?
What about the fact that it does the sanitized version, taking out the reference to Barth, talks about a male residence at the resident, a male resident, I should say, at the residence, who was selling drugs out of that location, and in addition to that, was in possession of a firearm. So we've got the connection between drugs and firearms, and also that the resident utilizes the firearm as a means of protection for controlled substance sales. So it's not just the mere fact that this somebody at this residence is a gun owner, and the CD never, when talking about the person there, described the person as a white male, 30 to 35 years old, with long blonde or reddish hair. CD never described person as Barth. That was something that came later.
The statement related to Barth, I guess, you know, my position would be the general statements related to Barth. I mean, the state and
right,
Mr.
But,
Hill.
But we have to look at what the sanitized version is. We have to look at it the way the district court did, by taking out Barth and looking actually at what the description is that the cooperating defendant provided. And the cooperating defendant described the person as a 30 to 35 year old white male with long blonde red hair. And so that's the resident. That's the person that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, the fact that he was selling marijuana out of that residence, he possessed a firearm, and in addition to the fact that we also have the information of a successful controlled buy of marijuana from that home, it just 3 days prior to the warrant application.
Well, Your Honor, so what we're looking at here is whether or not the facts are sufficient to justify an unannounced entry. I think a lot of the facts you've just brought up are relevant to, you know, probable cause about whether or not there could be a search related to drug sales, but it's a separate question of whether or not, you know, you can have an unannounced entry and do away with the constitutional requirement that police officers not can announce their presence. And in this case, we're dealing with just those two sentences. And I'm glad you bring up the controlled by the cooperating defendant, because frankly, we have a sentence that just says vaguely that this individual uses firearms as a means of protection as controlled substance sales, no other detail. And if there was a controlled buy conducted in this case, well, where is the cooperating defendant getting these facts? What did this happen at the controlled buy? Was there a gun present at the controlled buy? Because I haven't seen any facts related to that. You can look through the evidentiary hearing, and the officer doesn't represent anything along those lines.
Right, but so you still have the statement of a male resident at the residence who was selling drugs out of that location and was in possession of a firearm. That's connecting the drugs to the firearm.
Yeah, but we need to determine the reliability of that actual statement. And what
right.
I'm saying
the
is
reliability is brought about by the fact that there was a controlled buy with the cooperating defendant or the CD, and that the officer had been involved in. And the district court made very detailed findings, by the way, on that in terms of how that controlled buy took place.
Well, I think there's an important distinction to draw here, and that's, you know, I think all of that relates to probable cause. We're not saying that in the issue on whether or not there should have been an unannounced entry in this case is not whether or not drugs were being sold at the home. The issue is, was there dangerousness to officer, or was there a threat to officer safety? And I would say there aren't facts demonstrating that in the warrant application. And when we look at the warrant application, you know, if the cooperating defendant conducted a controlled buy and there was a weapon present, I mean, where are the facts showing that the cooperating defendant knows this? There is absolutely nothing.
And to that point, I actually, and making sure that we're clearly delineating these issues, I actually want to go back to a question that Judge Frisch raised, and that relates to the standard of review. What is mm-hmm. the standard of review that we have with respect to officers making an unannounced attempt at entering the residence,
residence? Your Honor, so in this case, the standard of review is de novo.
I'm not talking about our court. I'm talking about what is it that we look at with respect to the officers. Isn't it a reasonable, articulable suspicion?
Well, no, I would say it's not. I would say the standard for reasonable, articulable suspicion has been set out in this court's case in Anault, in Martinez, and the standard is a strong showing of sufficiently particularized circumstances. So circumstances particular
to explain. That's not a standard. We have standards of probable cause, reasonable, articulable suspicion, clearly erroneous, abuse of discretion. Isn't the standard of review here in terms of whether officers can make an unannounced entry into a residence, whether they have reasonable suspicion that knocking and announcing would be dangerous or futile? Isn't it the reasonable, articulable suspicion standard?
Well, the standard is the reasonable, articulable suspicion standard. And
okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Because you seem to, I mean, that is the standard. And what you seem to be arguing is that there's a different standard or a heightened standard. And that's where I had some confusion in terms of your arguments now and your briefing, but it's the reasonable articulable suspicion, and that's not a necessarily high standard. It's definitely lower than the standard for probable cause, correct?
Well, I would actually disagree with that. I would say in Minnesota we have case law in, you know, I would direct the court to Martinez and Anault that describe the reasonable articulable suspicion standard as a strong showing, a strong evidentiary showing. They don't, this is an important issue.
Let me just stop you there, because I think this is an important point. We have a reasonable articulable standard, reasonable articulable suspicion standard for determining whether or not officers are appropriately made an unannounced entry into a home. But under mm-hmm. that, there's case law that explains what is needed in order to be able to meet that standard. You need to have, I agree with you, the language talks about strong showing, but that doesn't change the standard of reasonable articulable suspicion. Reasonable articulable suspicion is a standard that's still different than the probable cause suspicion, which is a higher standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would agree that, you know, the probable cause standard, the reasonable articulable standard, we're operating obviously under different standards and different analyses. But, you know, the state kind of represents that this is a relatively low bar.
Case law does say that the bar for reasonable articulable suspicion is not high. There has to be some showing. They can't have general allegations. There has to be something there that you can point to, but it's not a high standard.
Yeah, what I would disagree on is that in general, the state takes this position in their briefing too, and you referenced this, that, you know, it's lower than probable cause. Well, but they're also separate standards. So you need to look at the warrant application and say, does this establish, you know, in this case, it would be a threat to officer safety. And I would say that there aren't sufficient facts to show that here. And, you know, in general, I would say that we need to keep in mind that just because the reasonable articulable suspicion standard has been described as a lower standard than probable cause. They're separate standards, and this court has found in various cases that probable cause was established, but the warrant application contained insufficient facts to warrant an unannounced entry. So this isn't a circumstance in which you say, oh, they've established probable cause, so they also have met the burden for reasonable articulable suspicion because it's a lower standard. That's not the case. They're different standards. And I point the court to, an example in which this court has concluded, yes, probable cause was established, but no, an unannounced entry was inappropriate. And, reversed on that case is State v. Schaefer, which is referenced in our briefing. So I think we need to bear in mind when we're conducting this analysis that these are different standards and different issues. The knock and announce requirement exists to protect your right to privacy, to protect, honestly, public safety as well. Is there risk to public safety when you have fully armed SWAT teams busting down doors? And so we have specific standards that say, officers, you need to make a strong showing of what is the threat to your safety in this case, or what is the likelihood of destruction of evidence before we're going to allow you to do away with the constitutional requirement that you knock and announce your presence. And so that's what we're dealing with in this case. And we need to look at the search warrant after it's been corrected and determine whether or not the state met its burden in this case. And so I realize I'm out of time. I'll save remaining points for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Young. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Mr. Schmidt.
May it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because the district court properly concluded that the search warrant application was supported by reasonable articular suspicion to authorize the no-knock entry. I have not argued that this court should affirm simply because it affirmed in the first case that probable cause was met to support the search warrant itself. In fact, in the brief, what we have argued is that the affidavit applying for the no-knock entry was particular to meet that reasonable articular suspicion standard. The particular facts that exist here are, one, that there is a particular specific location. Two, that inside that location, there is a resident. That resident is selling drugs. That resident is in possession of a gun. And that resident is using that gun to protect his drug sales. All of that combined with the fact that the cooperating defendant was corroborated by a controlled buy where the police were outside the house. He went in, bought drugs, came out and gave it to the police officers, is sufficient to meet reasonable articular suspicion.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
So it seems possible, at least theoretically possible, that the officer might have been able to elaborate on the statement that he, I'm looking now, utilizes his firearm as a means of protection. In other words, could have said on a prior occasion, someone has seen him utilize it. He has used it against so-and-so types of people and so on. Without knowing the specifics that the officer might have had in mind, is there anything else in the record that tells us what those specifics might be?
No, the affidavit is itself, the four corners here that we're looking at in terms of what is the record that was before the court. There was some testimony in regard to the Franks challenge and the first appeal, but in terms of the no-knock entry, it is pretty limited. But that limited amount is enough here to meet what is a low bar. Although it is a low bar, it is one that can be tripped over. But it is a low bar, and it is met here because of the particular circumstances of the cooperating defendant that said, I know this resident is in possession of a gun, and that gun is being used to protect drug sales.
So do we have case law, either Supreme Court or our court, that has found similarly statements of similar generality to be sufficient for those purposes?
Well, the Wasson case is one that is on point and that we've cited. But I would say that I don't think this is completely general. The court has held, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has held, that general statements are not enough. And this is not a general statement of an officer saying, in my training experience, drug dealers have guns and they use those guns. That is a very general statement. It is not a general statement like in Schaefer, for example, where it was, which the appellant cites, which is based on this person's criminal history, they have had guns in the past. That's a general statement that has been found to be invalid. And it's invalid because, as this court held in Schaefer, it was not specific to this house, to this particular search. It was in the past, this person happened to have guns. This is a sufficiently particular statement because it addresses this house, this residence, these drugs, and these drugs were confirmed and corroborated by a controlled buy. So we knew that even though it was a cooperating defendant and not a confidential, reliable informant, that defendant's then statement being corroborated about the drugs gives credence to the other statements that that defendant made about, for example, the gun. So it absolutely could be more. We always could have more in a search warrant. But that putting more into a search warrant could also then start to reveal the identity of the informant. And that's not an issue that's before the court right now. It has been brought up in other cases, and the Supreme Court recently ruled on that about informant identities. But the more you put in there about how that cooperating defendant learned that information, the more likely it is to identify that informant. And so, yes, the officer absolutely could have put more into this affidavit, but what was put into that affidavit was sufficiently corroborated and enough to show that officer safety could be at risk in doing a knock.
So is it fair to say that the case law is somewhat more lenient or permissive with respect to statements justifying the no-knock aspect of a warrant as compared to the case law concerning probable cause to search? Because, for example, if the warrant application, on the prior question, probable cause to search, if the warrant application had said simply, this person has dealt drugs in the past, or this person deals drugs, period, without any, you know, information about a controlled buy or anything else, I think we might sometimes, from case to case, find that that falls short of the probable cause, but because of its generality and so on. But am I correct in surmising that the sort of as to the requirements about specificity versus generality, is the case law different on those two questions?
Well, it's somewhat different because it's a lower bar. Probable cause is a higher standard that has to be met to be able to go in the house in the first place. And so with the reasonable articular suspicion, it is exactly that the officer's belief was reasonable, that there was a gun inside the house. It was articulated in the fact that the cooperating defendant gave some particularity statements about the residents inside this house, drug sales, using the gun to protect those drug sales. And so with that, the reasonable articular suspicion, and it was suspicious because of drug sales and gun. So that gives, with that lower standard, that is enough. It may not, that standard certainly may not be a probable cause finding here, but for a reasonable articular suspicion for a no-knock entry, that is enough. The only other piece that I would like to state is the appellant relies very heavily on State versus Amundson. That case does not stand for the proposition that presence of a fire alarm alone does not justify a no-knock entry. In fact, that case said that the gun was illegally obtained, or the reliance on the firearms in the house was struck from the warrant. So the evidence of that being illegally obtained was out, and so there was no evidence of a gun. So it's not on point, and it doesn't say, as appellant represents, that it is sufficient. Unless the court has other questions. Yes.
Mr. Schmidt, I do have a few questions. I want to go back to the warrant, and you talked about how you want to be careful in terms of providing too much information to reveal the identity of a cooperating defendant or a cooperating person. But at the same time, case law makes it very, very clear that there have to be particularized findings, and you have to have a strong showing that an unannounced entry is necessary. And here we've got information of a person possessing drugs, and then a separate statement that that person had been observed in possession of a handgun, but there's no statement linking the two together. In other words, there's no statement saying that the CD saw the person in the house selling drugs while in possession of a gun. So there's no linking of the two, and that would not, that's not information that would compromise the CD at all, but would seem to get it over the bar of even a reasonable articulable suspicion. Why is this information, which I think is pretty thin, why is that even enough? I mean, you acknowledge that there certainly could be more, but isn't more required here?
No, Judge, and I would disagree on just the fact that it's not linked. And I would disagree on the fact that the cooperating defendant said there's a gun, said that there's drugs, said that there's drug sales. But then the link is that the residents of this house uses that gun to protect the drug sales. That is the link. And so the fact that the cooperating defendant went into the house and did a controlled buy and came out with drugs, there's an inference that could be made that within that controlled buy, but that's not in the affidavit. But it is that additional information about using the gun to protect the drug sales is where the connection lies, where it is particular enough that it is particular to the residents, to the person, and to the drugs, and to the drug sales.
So you're relying on an inference to be made rather than something that's actually in the affidavit?
No, I'm relying on the thing that's in the affidavit, the words of the affidavit that says the residents of the house, the resident of the house uses the gun to protect his drug sales. So I'm relying on that. The fact that we know that drugs are being sold in the house, and we know that from the controlled buy. And we know that from the cooperating defendant that the resident of the house is in possession of a gun. And then the last statement is what makes the connection, that this gun is being used to protect the drug sales. Absolutely, there could be more. There always could be more. But that alone is enough for reasonable articular suspicion that officer safety may be in jeopardy to authorize the no-knock entry.
And I just have one last question, and that's, let's assume for the sake of argument that we conclude that the warrant application does not meet the reasonable suspicion standard. You argue that we should adopt the Hudson analysis by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the Minnesota Supreme Court, our Supreme Court has never adopted that. And we generally don't, that seems to be more of a policy issue for the Minnesota Supreme Court to adopt, which is an error-correcting court. So I question what authority we'd even have to adopt it, even if we wanted to as a Court of Appeals.
And Judge, I agree. This is an argument that I'm making to preserve it for the Minnesota Supreme Court in the event that you reverse and disagree with me. And so I need to make the argument here in order to raise it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has, as you said, not yet adopted that standard. I would then, if we lose here, I would advocate to the Supreme Court that they should reevaluate their case law and adopt Hudson.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Unless the court has any other questions, I will rely on the brief, and we ask that you affirm.
It appears there are no, Judge Frisch, do you have any questions? She does not. Okay, thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Young, as we stated earlier, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point I'd just like to follow up on is, you know, the state was asked in its argument, is there anything in the record, you know, telling us or clarifying this second sentence, this vague sentence of utilizes this firearm as a means of protection? And the state said no. We literally had multiple evidentiary hearings. We had Frank's hearings on this motion, and the officer was called to testify, testified as to everything in the warrant application, everything the cooperating defendant told him, and provided zero clarification as to this vague sentence. And I think that is incredibly telling as to the reliability of this sentence and the fact that it wasn't corroborated. You know, there's absolutely no specificity in this sentence. There's nothing saying when the cooperating defendant saw this individual with the gun. Does he carry the gun with him regularly? Was it seen in the course of controlled by?
So Mr. Young, wait, what's your best case where a similarly vague or unspecific statement was determined to not be sufficient, and where the court reversed on that ground? What's the case that we should look to when measuring the specificity or vagueness of this statement, and that would cause us to be compelled to reverse?
Yes, Your Honor, I would look to a few cases. I think, Garza v. State stands for the general proposition that we can't have just boilerplate statements. I would characterize this, frankly.
Be clear about my question. I'm asking for cases in which there was a reversal. I mean, stating forth the general principles is always necessary, of course, but sometimes the most illustrative cases are those where we look at the result, where we can look both at the language of the application and then look at the result, and then that helps us, draw a line about what is necessary. So do you have any cases that are this case where the appellate court's reversed?
Well, I would say the case that's most factually on point is the Schaefer case, and Mr. Schmidt addressed that case. I would say that is very factually analogous to this case. In that case, the officer conducted three separate controlled buys. There was detailed allegations in the search warrant application related to prior crimes committed by this suspect. And those prior crimes related to, significant drug sales where firearms were present. There was one allegation of a crime committed where there were drug sales with stolen weapons present, and a number of instances in which this individual fled from the police, both in a vehicle and on foot. So I think you had five or six separate criminal charges all related to this. And all of that, I would think, it's far more detailed than what's included in this search warrant application. And it indicates dangerousness to officers. This guy has been involved in, drug sales with stolen guns and has fled police. All of that indicates, I think, a dangerousness to officers. And this court held that's insufficient. This court said, you had enough based on those three controlled buys for probable cause to conduct the search, but you did not show sufficient dangerousness to officers. So we are reversing.
Mr. Young, I note that case is an unpublished case, which is not binding precedent. It provides persuasive value. And so definitely we will consider it in that way. Is there any precedential case law that you have where an appellate court reversed with statements that are similar to the statements here in terms of lack of specificity?
Well, I would say, I think it's the generalized principles that are set forth in these different cases, like Garza v. State. I think, in general, it's the principles that, boilerplate language isn't sufficient. You need to show some specificity. I would say in general, Schaefer is most on point. And these principles that you can pull from these other cases, very well established that this is insufficient. And I would also say, just in general, that the remedy is, exclusion of evidence. The state brought up in its argument that this court should adopt Hudson v. Michigan. We would oppose that, obviously. The Supreme Court has not addressed that issue, has not adopted it. In fact, cases from the Minnesota Court of Appeals following Hudson have applied the exclusionary rule in violations of the knock and announce rule. So this court should do so here, take that burden, and the only remedy is exclusion of evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. And Mr. Young, assuming you're appearing pro bono, thank you for your service to the court system. It's always helpful to everybody in the system. The case is submitted.